The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi there. Welcome to The Good Place, the podcast.
I've really gotten into podcasts since we started this. Did you know the number one podcast in The Good Place is Mozart and Jimi Hendrix talking about music? And the number one podcast in The Bad Place is Joseph Stalin recapping The Bachelor.
Hope you enjoy this week's episode.
Welcome to The Good Place, the podcast. I'm Mark Evan Jackson. I play Sean. Today we will discuss Chapter 30, Season 3, Episode 3, The Snowplow, written by Joe Mandy, including guest cast Maya Rudolph, Kirby Howell-Baptiste, Ben Lawson, Adam Groves, John Leary, and Ilka Urbach. After Michael and Janet escape to Earth, they set up surveillance of the humans. They decide to help the four along in their ethical journey by solving problems such as Eleanor needing money and Tahani needing a romantic partner. This backfires when Larry Hemsworth proposes to Tahani and they plan to leave Australia. Chidi and Simone call for the group to take a break so they can apply for grants, leading Michael and Janet to scramble in order to keep the group together. Eleanor lashes out due to losing the only group she's ever been a part of and ends up apologizing. Michael and Janet decide to go sneak into the judges' chambers and figure out how to reset the Earth timeline, but the humans catch them, opening the magical door. My guests today are production designer Ian Phillips and director of the episode, Beth McCarthy Miller. Beth and Ian, welcome. Everything is Earth.
Hi, Mark.
Thanks so much for being here. First things first, what is a production designer?
Production designer is a person that oversees the look and design of a TV show or a film.
Mm-hmm. And this is your first season on the show, right?
That is correct.
It's my understanding from just moments ago from Morgan Sackett that they asked you to do this in season one and you said no. They asked you to do this in season two and you said no.
I think Morgan's falsifying information
is that
slightly,
right?
But, I'll let him run with it.
Okay.
I did get offered season one.
So that's true.
This is true.
So far, so his story tracking.
Right.
His story's tracking.
Yes. And then the date kept pushing.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, everybody has bills to pay. So I ended up taking another show and having to turn down The Good Place. And then it was pretty much the same thing on season two.
Is that right?
Yes.
That's such a tricky thing in Hollywood that I think people don't realize. I've spoken to some of the writers about this. This is a 13-episode season, this show. So, the term of employment is shorter than on a show that does 22 episodes a season or whatever. And it's, I think, difficult sometimes to, you know, realize that some people are going to take other jobs. You want to hold out and see if you get picked up so that maybe you don't have to take another job, which would prevent you from coming back in another season kind of thing. Is that true with directors as well, Beth?
You know, it depends. With directors, you're kind of a slave to the schedule and you're kind of like a freelance whore. So you can schedule your year.
Rather than a termed contract whore.
Yes, exactly. Okay. You know, some directors are attached to a show, but usually when the season's, you know, after upfronts, you kind of schedule your year. The big thing with The Good Place is because it shoots in the spring, you sometimes have to make a choice. Are you going to leave it open in case maybe a pilot comes up, or right, are you going to schedule yourself?
Yeah, and that vastly is different from most of the crew, because most of the crew will stay on for the whole run of the show. And for myself, I'm prepping anywhere from 6 to 8 weeks before we even begin shooting, and then until the very last day of shooting.
What's the difference between a production designer and an art director? Like, what's the family tree? We've talked to Kimberly Wanup. We've talked to Camille, like locations and set decorator. We've talked to properties. What's the schematic of
so the way that it lays out is a production designer is the department head. Mm-hmm. Below the production designer is the art director, and the art director typically is dealing with the budgets and hardware and sort of sourcing materials that the production designer has chosen. Then there's the set designer, who's Camille, who you spoke with. And Camille, or any set designer, does the architectural drawings. Typically, I come up with a design, and I'll either do a sketch, or sometimes it's just verbal. And I will pass that on to Camille, and then between the two of us, we'll work out sort of the kinks as to what the set needs to be. Then below that, there's an art department coordinator who handles essentially purchasing all of the items that have been selected.
Furniture or props or all of it?
No, typically it's for just the art department. It would be your flooring, your material choices, wallpapers, and if there's frosting
things that
on the
raw,
windows.
Like materials that bulk.
Absolutely.
Really?
Absolutely. Yeah. And then from there, we typically have a graphic designer, and the graphic designer works with me in order to produce all of the signage and the artwork that you see on the sets, and anything from taxi cab graphics mm-hmm. to giant graphics that get put in on post.
To up to and including Jacksonville Sheriff's Department logos Absolutely. On doors?
Like specific yes. props, too, yeah. like if there's a joke prop,
yeah. Yeah.
graphics department makes it as well.
That's amazing.
Yeah, the writers on this show typically come up with the funny names, and then we produce the funny graphics.
Amazing. Now, so is your background in art primarily, or in architecture or design, or what?
It's self-taught.
That's a common theme on this show.
Yes.
Truly, we're finding people.
And
that,
in Hollywood.
His background is biology. No,
yes,
I'm kidding.
It is.
Not. Is it?
It is, yes.
Oh, that was such
biochem.
A good,
yes.
Wait, why did you know
biochem?
That?
I did it by accident.
I think we've discussed it probably in scouting somewhere. I'm pretty sure.
That may have been in a corner of your brain somewhere. Beth, you know what I don't know? How does it work when you're looking at a new job? Do you get consulted about what sort of script you want to direct? Do they bring in a specific director if it's an action-heavy episode or a relationship-heavy episode?
I will say this. Most of new shows, when you get picked up, the shows after upfronts in May, which is that thing where all the networks, you know, kind of say what their season's going to be and what new shows they've picked up,
mm-hmm.
That's when you start getting called for directing, and the writers' rooms haven't even opened up yet. So you get booked for the fall. So lots of times that doesn't happen. What has happened in the past has been if there is a specific type of episode, they might shuffle your weeks in case, you know, if they want one director to do something, then another director. That sometimes happens. You know, when I did the live 30 Rocks, they made sure that I was available to do those because I was at a specific skill of directing live because I have a lot of past experience in that.
Those were amazing, by the by.
Thanks.
Yeah.
But no, not on a lot of shows. Sometimes you just get lucky, and I would knock on wood, but there's none around me.
Room.
I'll knock on my head. I have been absolutely blessed in my career in Half Hours because I get a lot of great scripts, and I've just been really lucky. And a show like this, every script is a blessing. So
I mean, it's a gold mine, right?
Pretty much is.
You directed the Tahani Al-Jamil episode.
I did.
You directed the Existential Crisis episode.
Yes, I did.
One in season one, one in season two. Now we're on Earth. Did you go about this any differently from a directorial perspective because of what you now know about the show and where we are?
I think when you are a repeat customer on a show, I think you just get better as a director just because you know the show better mm-hmm. and you know the characters better and you know the nuts and bolts of the departments better. So you feel more comfortable and confident in speaking about things about the show as opposed to like the first time you do an episode of something. And especially when it's a new show. Also, the first season, There was a lot of location stuff. There was a lot of things to try to make The Good Place look like The Good Place. So right. It was very specific. And, you know, you have amazing producers on the show. And Mike is so great with his vision. And Drew, who did the pilot, was so great about his vision, too, that when you walked in and you're reading something on the page, we're like, where are we going to find this place? And, yeah. And it's like, oh, let's go to Huntington Gardens. It was like, oh, this is perfect. You guys are awesome.
We've talked about that. That serves a lot of purposes on the show, doesn't it, as a location?
Yeah.
It's gorgeous there.
Absolutely stunning.
I'm a member. It's wonderful.
You had to drop that, didn't you?
Yes, of course. Like that's a little bit, when I moved to California, not California, but Los Angeles specifically, it's mostly concrete. Like it's not glamorous. And so my wife found the Huntington early on and it was like, oh, green, respite.
Yeah, beautiful.
I mean, it's such a nice place just to spend an afternoon.
And surprisingly, there's quite a few of those places around LA that people don't know about.
You got to go look for them.
Yes.
Exactly.
And that's a very specific... And also the visual effects are big on this show. So you really have to be aware of that. And you don't worry about that on other half hours that you do. Usually when I do a new show, if it's up and running, I'll ask the showrunner to send me their three favorite episodes. So that way I kind of get a feel.
That's very smart.
And I ask them to, you know, think about a great episode that you loved all the character dynamic in it, and an episode that you loved the way it looked. So that way I get kind of a feel of the show and what the showrunner loves. Because, you know, the job of the episodic director as opposed to the pilot director is, you know, you want to put your stamp on the episode, but the show needs to look like the show.
It has to be canon to the current programming.
Yes. And that's part of your job, is to make sure that in your directing, you also still make the show feel like it's the show.
Right. That's a delicate balance, I would guess.
It is.
At the beginning of this episode, we find Janet and Michael in the bathroom. They've come. And Ian, I want to ask you a production thing that came up a couple of weeks ago in the season 3 premiere. The bridge that the doorman is on, the very outskirt of the, that we find Michael Malley.
So on,
with his, you know, do not duplicate key and his frog keychain. The design of that felt a lot like the dock where Manny meets Zach Pizzazz. Like just the layout, the lights, the spacing of all that. Is that a deliberate choice? Do you think in broad strokes like that, or was that completely accidental?
You know, that was completely accidental.
I'll move on. No, truly?
It was absolutely accidental. It's, you know, typically when we scout, you know, we're scouting an episode ahead, but the bridge had been created for the first episode.
Right.
So, you know, it was, I knew what I wanted the bridge to look like, and I knew that it had to be well lit. And because a lot of it was extended in visual effects, we built 80 feet of the actual
bridge. A lot of it was
bridge.
Practical.
Yes.
Yeah, a lot of it.
So after that, it was all visual effects. So we knew what we had to create in order to light the character and build the set, so that it could be extended. But then, of course, when you go to a dock, it's very similar in the way that it's...
it's dimension, it's shape, right?
Right, yeah. Right.
Interesting. One of the things I found very satisfying about this episode is that Michael and Janet surveil the... you know, Janet doesn't have her powers. She does have all the knowledge she had acquired up until that point. So she installs cameras. And I think some of the magic of this show is like, where did she get money? Where did she get cameras? Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter. Promotional consideration is furnished by this completely authentic sponsor.
Buzzer Beater lightly expired cocktail shrimp. Only 99 cents per 5 pounds. Because sometimes the best under the wire deals make the best meals. Warning, Buzzer Beater brand lightly expired cocktail shrimp has been classified by the FDA as a decorative item only. Not fit for human consumption. But who cares what those nerds at the FDA think? Not you. You're too busy wolfing down delicious bargain price shrimpies by the handful. Try Buzzer Beater today before it's actually too late.
It's fun to see Michael and Janet wearing, ironically, like modern and yet less effective surveillance gear, like headphones with wires. We've never seen those two wear that stuff before. Somehow their Bad Place ticker tapes seem like it's higher tech, even though it's decidedly the opposite. It's very interesting to see those two wearing this equipment. And then talk a little bit about how you shoot with our cameras what feels like surveillance video with the pans and zooms and stuff. Do you degrade the footage to make it feel like it's not great cameras?
We put in some GoPro cameras and made them in positions where there were security cameras. So we were shooting our three cameras and we had the camera guys shoot like it was a toggle switch and zooming in and, you know, and not very, you know, smooth camera work. But we also had big high and wide shots that while we were shooting the scene, we'd shoot the scene and then pull our cameras out and then do the scene again.
Just on GoPros? Really?
Yeah. Just so we had a bunch of, because we didn't know how, you know, in post, you don't know how much of that security footage they're going to use.
Right.
And they wanted to build it into four quadrants. So we literally, almost every scene of that episode, after we shot it and we were happy with it, pulled all of the show cameras out and shot them with GoPros.
That's so interesting.
And it took a long time.
Did it?
Well, it definitely took more time than it normally set. Yeah.
Right. But you, I think, always want to have more rather than
Absolutely.
Get in the edit suite and be like, ooh.
Exactly.
We don't have it.
And typically, during those two, when you have your cameras set up, your show cameras, you take out walls and you take out set dressing and you just to get your camera position. And when you shoot surveillance footage, especially if it's after,
it needs to be a play.
You have to have everything reset and back to the position that it needs to be so that it all matches when you do see the footage versus the security footage.
We've learned that there's no way, the reason that the Michael and Janet are surveilling them is because there's no way to track the point totals. The accountants do that and they're still in the afterlife. It begins not well for Eleanor. She farts in class and blames it on her chair. It occurred to me that there's actually an SFX of a fart.
Yeah.
Yes.
Has to be.
Where does that come from? Is that a stock thing?
Kristen did it for
us. Is that right?
No, she did not.
I love that she blames it on a bowl.
Stock footage, yes.
We also learned that, at least for the moment, Trevor is out. He gets flicked away in a prior episode by the judge. And Michael writes a very funny email saying that he's too ugly and too stupid, I think.
Yes.
And that he's got to go home to his mommy.
Yeah.
Michael's very proud about that.
So proud of himself.
Oh, my goodness. There seems to be a little bit of a cake through line in this show. We begin with cupcakes, which seems to be, you know, the campfire that people gather around. And then later we see a sheet cake, which we'll talk about then. But it's an interesting sort of through line of
And there's
also evolution.
A birthday cake, but it ended up being in those
in a montage.
In the montage.
Yeah.
But that was actually a little scene.
The theme of this, the title of the show is The Snowplow. It's Michael and Janet, you know, sort of clearing the way for Eleanor to drive down the road of improvement. And we see her do so. We also see her falter. There's some really human moments in this episode. When you see Kristen as Eleanor get defensive, and it's painful.
Yeah, no, it's brilliantly conveyed by Kristen, but it's a really cool arc for all of the characters, I think. And I think Eleanor's arc in this episode is unbelievable. And the Michael and Janet stuff is really fun because it's the first time you really kind of see them as like the dynamic duo, and they bicker with each other a little bit in this episode, which is super fun to see.
And new.
Yeah.
Janet is a different Janet. It feels as though maybe being unmoored from her powers has accelerated her evolution.
Humanity,
Right, because she's almost snarky. Later in the episode, she's like, maybe no accent.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's kind of catty. Gets,
and Ted got beautifully insulted by it. It was so great.
It's a fun moment, too, when... he does the accent anyway moments later,
and
you have a nice insert of her going like, tried to warn you, bro. Tried to warn you. I love the, I believe that at the end of this show, someday when it is not renewed, someone's going to put together all the numbers that have ever been spoken, and it will be a code to a Swiss bank account or something. Janet has the knowledge of everything of the universe prior to leaving the afterlife. And she knows which lottery ticket wins. It's
right.
Number 186 from the bottom. And Eleanor wins $18,000, which is a great plot fix because it means that she can stay in her program and stay with them. I love that Tahani's unimpressed, that she's like, oh, I see.
Oh,
yeah.
That's actually,
now taking in context.
$18,000 is a lot. Yeah.
Where was that on a back lot somewhere? Where did you set up that sort of convenience store?
No,
that
on location.
Convenience store was on location, yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. But did you make those lottery tickets?
We did make the lottery tickets and all of the posters that are...
There's this Australian kind of stuff that's merchandising and stuff on the walls.
Yeah, we tried to get as many real things from Australia that we could gather. Of course, it has to come from Australia, and typically we have 5 days to do that. So sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't.
Because that's far away.
It is far away, as it turns out, from Hollywood.
Yeah. I feel like those things are often very dense with jokes as well. I also think, with specific reference to Australia, I think it's funny because I think that it's a very American perception of Australia stuff that, like, oh, they just have posters of koalas and kangaroos around.
Right. Everywhere.
Like, which is, of course, not the case, but it's absolutely our perception of what it's like down under. We should talk to you, I suppose. We understand that whenever there are notebooks or, for instance, the Kierkegaard rap, like, it's my understanding that that's not just the top page, that there are other things behind that that the art department is responsible for.
We really do try to fill up as much as we can for the actors because it makes it easier for them to do their jobs. If there are multiple pages in there, then you can kind of flip through. If you only have one page and you got to stop right there, it makes it a challenge. I'm sure you can relate. I mean, it's the same thing with filling desk drawers when people are in offices. It's great to be able to go in and find some weird thing, and all of a sudden that becomes a part of your character because that's all you've done is play with it.
Yes.
And it's fun to go out and find that stuff. And that's typically the props team that does that. But, you know, I'll walk onto a set, and if there's a notepad there, I'll just start writing things on it.
Make it look
and,
not brand new, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. And I think it's fun, too, to develop the character in my own head and try and relate to what the character's actually doing. So we really try and build all of that stuff long before anybody ever gets on set.
That stuff is super informative. Like, you know, I think that as an actor, you can show up to set in the morning and go like, oh, this is who I think this is. And then you're like, oh, this is my desk? Okay, that does shade it. It informs it in small ways of like, oh, I'm super fastidious, or I'm a total slob.
Right.
It changes it. It really does. Yeah. Speaking of Down Under, I love that Jason is having difficulty watching the Jaguars because he's almost in a different zone of time. No, that sounds stupid. A different clock land.
Yes. Such a great line.
Tahani name drops Tom Brady. And so in this new iteration of these characters getting to know each other, this new Eleanor is like, no, I'll never not get it. I get it every time.
But she does it sweetly. She doesn't do it with an eye roll because she has from the beginning liked Tahani.
Right.
At
they connected immediately on this iteration.
Exactly.
And she's also trying to not be a trash bag, as she says. Mm-hmm. She's really making an effort.
Yeah.
Michael and Janet have to intercede again because Tahani is mad horny and is pursuing Jason, which of course makes Janet a little bit, she's
not happy.
Not great. and she does that sort of like, look, if you want, like, I'm not saying I want to, but if you want to. There's a danger in being on Earth that we don't have the infinity of the afterlife and all the VFX that we've enjoyed and exploiting it. And then we meet Superboard. Is that what it's called?
Yes, Superboard.
Yeah. Superboard, like this amazing virtual board with robotic like kiosks for tablets and stuff. It's not necessarily necessary. Is it just a device to exploit within the episode and within this new?
I think it was just showing that once they decided to open up the snowplow where we can do things to intervene to make things better. It's the snowball effect, not to use another snow reference, but it's the effect of once they've opened that can of worms, they keep tinkering.
Right.
And the tinkering is going to come back to bite them in the butt.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, Eleanor needs money.
Right.
Well, while they need money, you know, well, she needs money. You know, I'd like them to have a little more, you know, a better learning experience.
Well, he wants it to speed up their learning, right?
Exactly.
As well, like, to speed up the process,
he wants it for that, but I mean, it was, you know, make things a little bit nicer for them. And then immediately Janet wants to buy Jason jean shorts.
And I think part of that too is that visually you have to show all of that, just like Beth is talking about. Otherwise, it becomes a 4-hour episode of saying, oh, well, this person needs more money and this person needs more money. And how are we going to exploit the fact that all of a sudden they now can conduct the study to keep all four of these people together. Mm-hmm. And it's our job in the art department to visually tell that story, to say, oh, look, they did get money. All of a sudden, they've got Superboard, and that thing is rad.
Superboard's kind of cool.
Yeah.
So how much of Superboard was practical? Obviously, some of it's visual effects, but were the kiosks real?
They were fun. They were fun. Everyone's having a really good time figuring out how to make those work.
Wait, are they actually robotic? They're not.
Yes,
they're not skateboards with someone pushing a green screen stick
they're
in.
Specifically made, and actually, they used one on Modern Family a couple of years ago.
Yeah, they're for teleconferencing essentially, and we were able to figure out how to reprogram the existing monitor with graphics that we had created, so it appeared as if that Superboard was being controlled by this crazy thing.
Wow. And then the board itself.
The board itself was our whiteboard from that was there, and then they put VisFX on top of it.
David Neednuggle to the rescue.
Exactly.
Coming in with his magics.
Yeah.
I felt like there were also tablets that the cast had out
in
the audience?
Yeah, those were just iPads that they put fancy holders on, which looked great. Yeah. The art department did a great job with that. And those iPads that came in, we had to do that several times because it was one guy operating one guy operating the other, and trying to get them to come in at the exact same time.
Sure.
And they have cameras on them.
Yeah.
So because they're teleconferencing machines,
right?
They have cameras so that you can visually tell where you're supposed to be driving. And of course, you have two guys that are sitting off stage
trying to hit a mark
with these
and
robots.
And their faces couldn't be in there either, because that's what usually happens. Your face is in there and then you can see and move yourself around. They're awesome guys.
Amusing.
Get one for the kids.
But I mean, like, you've made it so much harder for yourselves.
No, we absolutely did.
Oh,
but
the
guys did a great job. It just took a couple takes. It
takes a couple times and everybody gets it.
Beth, I heard you say before we began that you watched the episode and were surprised at how much had to be cut out, which I think is a consistent thing, especially in a show like this, right?
It's a really dense show.
Yeah.
And God bless the editors and Mike and producers that, after they get my cut that's way too long, that they figure out how to cut it down and still have it make sense and have everything that's important in it, because the scripts are really dense. They're so well done, but they're full of stories. So there were some things that were a little longer that ended up being in these like four squares that were accelerating time, 3 months later, 6 months later. Yeah.
One of those, I heard you say, was Manny in jean shorts.
It was. And originally it was like him sitting under a tree reading like Kierkegaard. And then he stands up and we widen out and he's got the tight jean shorts on with the, and poor Manny. So he comes on set with them and I'm like, they're not short enough.
Oh,
and
wow.
They're literally, we're cutting them shorter and shorter.
They became Daisy Dukes, essentially.
I was embarrassed for myself and for Manny, but he was a good sport.
He's a gamer, right?
He's totally game friend. They all are. They're all just total pros. And
it's
except for you.
I do feel it a personal affront that I've never been in an episode you've directed.
I've made sure of that.
Oh, wow.
I'm kidding.
She's staring at me very darkly right now. This is uncomfortable.
Yes.
Another element of the four square is a birthday scene. I feel like they're singing to Chidi. Is it Chidi's birthday?
They are. And that was a callback from, and that was a scene that ended up being in the four shot. But that Eleanor, when they bring out the cupcake, she's like, I really don't like to be part of group things.
That's right.
The thing I hate the most is that opening note on the hat. And we actually shot a scene where Eleanor's holding the cake, smiling, you know, with her shirt, eating grin, and she's doing that opening note for Chidi's birthday. So
she's, it's as you say, this show is so dense. That's something that she openly stated that she despises. Mm-hmm. And yet her friendship with this group, the only group to which she's ever felt belonging, she's willing to do it for these friends.
And if anybody knows anything about music clearance, you can sing Happy Birthday now for hardly any money.
Finally.
So. That's new, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
That used to be cut out of things.
Now it's in whatever that thing is called.
Public domain.
Public domain.
Yeah.
You're smart.
You know. You can find full episodes of The Good Place on NBC.com or the NBC app. Let's listen to a clip.
Why did I do that?
Okay, here's my guess. As humans evolved, the first big problem we had to overcome was me versus us. Learning to sacrifice a little individual freedom for the benefit of a group. You know, like sharing food and resources so we don't starve or get eaten by tigers, things like that.
Okay, with you so far.
The next problem to overcome was us versus them, trying to see other groups different from ours as equals. That one we're still struggling with. That's why we have racism and nationalism and why fans of Stone Cold Steve Austin hate fans of The Rock.
No, we hate The Rock because he went Hollywood and Stone Cold keeps it real, so The Rock's fans are the real jabronis. Point made. Keep going.
Well, what's interesting about you is I don't think you ever got past the me versus us stage. I mean, have you ever been part of a group that you really cared about?
I was in the Girl Scouts.
Really?
Technically, I joined under a fake name because I wanted to steal a bunch of cookies.
See? The Brainy Bunch is basically the first group that became part of your self-identity, and now that's breaking up. You're feeling this new kind of loss, and you're scared of going back to being alone. I mean, that's just my guess. The other possible medical diagnosis is that you're just a bit of a dick.
Why don't you take my cab? I think me needs to go apologize to us. And thank you.
Watch new episodes of The Good Place Thursdays, 8:30, 7:30 Central. This show is special. That scene could have been so boring, like so pedagogical, so pedantic. And it's one of those evidences that Mike has talked about on this podcast and in many panels that one of the marching orders for the show was that they wanted to sort of ask and answer a philosophical question in every episode. And the me versus us and us versus them is a decently complicated concept and one that, again, could have been boring. But to illustrate it and make light of it at the same time, the writers use Stone Cold Steve Austin and The Rock to illustrate it. Like it's such a lovely way. It also talks about their friendship because Simone knows they've been together for 3 months and 3 months more or however long. Simone's heard Eleanor talk about Stone Cold Steve Austin, so she knows to you, like they're friends.
I think the big thing about that and that scene and, you know, those are the scenes that as a director, when you're in a tone meeting with the showrunner or with Mike or with the writer, those are those scenes that, you know, to Mike's absolute credit from a million other things you can credit him for, is that he really impresses upon you how important that those certain things land. And one of those things is the whole reason why they did the Stone Cold Steve Austin is that it did a layer of things. It showed that Simone's great at her job because she figured out that this was the way Eleanor was going to get it. Wow. Was that she put it into terms that Eleanor could understand, which lots of times when someone who has a scientific mind can't really do that. So yeah. You see how good Simone is at her job. And also that you see that there is a connection there. There is a friendship there. And And it's so, so well written and so poignant. And it's true. It was such a great sneaky way to tell that lesson and talk about that philosophical thing and lay exposition without it not feeling it goes by and you're just caught up in the moment.
It's a beautiful moment. It takes place after Eleanor has stormed out of this mansion. That's a real mansion, I presume, with yes. real high-end sports cars out front.
Yes, real high-end we sports cars and a real mansion.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you budget episode by episode or season by season?
Episode by episode. And we have a budget typically at the beginning that sort of runs the course of the season, which is a lot of our permanent sets and our
backings. It includes all that.
And yes.
Yeah. I will never understand how anybody can get anywhere close to an estimate of 13 episodes, you know, 23, 22 on other shows. That's
a
astounding.
Lot of practice and a lot of guessing.
A lot of guessing?
A lot of guessing and a lot of practice. And you get, you know, in the ballpark.
It seems like a funny sort of almost Hollywood inside joke reference too. There's a sheet cake. Typically on a television show, you bring out a sheet cake for the show after like 100 episodes or something, which for a show of 13 episodes would be 7.6 seasons or something like that. But how many takes of Kristen actually ruining the cake did you? How many fire in the hole cake?
I think we only did what we try to do is we try to shoot the whole scene up to it.
Sure.
So we have that and it's done and it's nailed. And then we just pick it up from the breaking of the sheet cake. So I think we only did it three. I think we only ruined three cakes.
Okay. And from an art department perspective, do you know how many they had ready to go?
I feel like we probably had six. Three or did we have more?
I think
more
you
than
might
that?
Have had like five.
Really?
It wouldn't surprise me if we had more. I mean, this is Mike Schur's favorite food, I think, is cakes, because as far back as I can remember and as long as I've worked with Mike Schur,
which was Parks and Rec,
of course, we had a million cakes.
And banners. I think that could be, cakes and banners. I think it could be Parks and Rec : cakes and banners.
I agree. I feel like that's, we spent a lot of time with cakes and banners.
Be a great name for a band.
Sure. This show is a particular band name generator. Like, mm-hmm. there are things that come up in the podcast almost every week that I'm like, that could be a band name.
Exactly.
I mean, that just speaks to the Andy Dwyer of Parks and Rec, because how many band names did that guy have?
Yep, exactly.
Oh, and Mike Schur.
Mouse Rat.
Yeah.
Speaking of Parks and Rec, Eleanor goes back in to apologize to her group and say, like, I'm sorry, I was a bit of a dick. I'm not really an I'm sorry kind of person. Behind her on the stairs is a purse, a bottle of some kind of liquor, and a bottle of Lagavulin. That seems like a reference to something.
Well, she left. When she left and was hiding in the bushes, mm-hmm. we had her leave and she kind of stole some booze from the party.
Yeah.
So we just had her bring it back in.
Okay.
And since originally she was like coming in with the cake and then apologizing, then we had her get rid of the cake in the scene before with Simone. Also, in that, I don't think it ended up in the episode, she hugs Simone, and when Simone turns around to go get in the cab, he had a handprint of cake.
A cakey handprint.
It was.
And she's like, sorry, I'll get that dry cleaned. Was it in the episode?
No, I don't think it
did.
Okay, I don't think it made it.
No,
yeah,
not.
It was super funny.
Kill your darlings, right?
I mean,
you gotta just.
No, it is. You gotta lay on the sword for something. You gotta lay on the sword for 21 minutes and 30 seconds.
The Lagavulin does harken back, though, to Nick Offerman's.
A little
character.
Bit of Ron Swanson.
Yes,
Ron
that Swanson. They knew that they could clear it.
Yeah.
That must be, right?
Yeah.
I think it says something about me that I can see that on my phone in 2 pixels and be like, that's Lagavulin.
That's Lagavulin. Yeah,
I may have a problem. There's a hiccup here too. The Simone and Chidi have said, like, we should take a break. We should assess the results we have so far, maybe get together again in a year after we've applied for some grants. And from Michael and Janet's perspective, that's red alert. Like, that's a big problem, because that's going to delay the efforts to get them together, to make one another better, to up their points on Earth so that they can get into the good place. A year is a huge amount of time. That's a big deal. Michael freaks out. Like, Michael loses it.
And he freaks out because, and that was a very pointed thing as well, and that was also another layer to the episode. But he freaks out because his story and his journey is very similar to what Eleanor is going through. Because without those four people, what does he have for existence too?
Point?
So I think he is having a similar, without it being thrown in your face and without it being, shown a spotlight on it, he's basically having the same emotional crisis that Eleanor is having.
Mm-hmm.
Because without those four people, who is he and what is he doing?
There's nothing to go back to.
Yeah.
He knows that the judge is waiting for him.
He'll be retired.
Yeah.
Janet will be marbleized.
Exactly.
Game over.
Exactly.
What's the point?
And also, he connects with these people and he cares about them and he wants this to happen for them. Yeah.
How many reboots has he watched them have?
I know, right?
This is 803, right?
I know.
In effect. And here we find ourselves once again. The reason is friends.
Like,
it's about connection. It's about being part of a group that you care about. This show is dense for story, but it's also dense for jokes. There's a joke early on where Michael and Janet find an abandoned department, the journalism department, bad for the world, good for us.
Funny.
Airbnb, this show with its puns. This is not AIRBNB.
No.
It's HEIR.
Yes. Where I love that she says you can swap mansions, yachts, and blimp hangers.
Blimp hangers.
That made me so happy.
She's an oldie-timey, like, land baron kind of.
So there's strange. A lot of old money going on there.
Oh, my goodness.
A lot of old money.
And by the way, we had a really good time coming up with the perfect joke that Manny, when he asks Larry Hemsworth about his brothers, we had so many jokes. And I'm so glad the Miley Cyrus one got in, because it.
Was it your pitch? That's so great. It's told in a funny way, too, because it's not just direct of, like, your brothers. It's, is it true that Miley Cyrus wrote the song Wrecking For Ball Chris's about Chris's brother, Liam, who is also Larry's brother? They're brothers. Those are brothers one to another, right?
It was so funny.
It's so convoluted. And I'm realizing now that I almost forgot to mention Manny getting body painted green with spots to be fantastic. The Jaguars Australia chapter of the Jaguars fan club. What, did you cut those shorts shorter, tighter pants? Like what?
No.
What was the production design for that? What were the
that
conversations?
That was makeup and hair and
did it take
wardrobe.
A half a day?
They did a great job. It took and like an hour in the morning. I think we shot basically that whole scene, and then we sent him away, and then we shot the top of the scene, and then had him come in. It was pretty fantastic. You know, there was another scene that got cut, where Eleanor goes to talk to Tahani, and I had everybody else, because we were at the mansion anyway, in the background. And I said to Manny, you know, just to kind of walk around and do some stuff in the background. And I said, maybe you can like keep taking stuff off of the trays, like, you know, hoard up on hors d'oeuvres. And then at one point I see him walk back in the background, and he had taken like candlesticks and stuff from the mansion, and he's just walking by with them under his arm.
As he's exiting that scene, Jason is in the body paint, and he says, I'm going to go do something, and I'll be back to study philosophy. And then he yells something. It sounds like he's saying Duval.
What does that? He says that. Joe Mandy, who is the writer of the episode, threw that in there because apparently they get letters from Jacksonville fans. From Jacksonville Jaguar fans. It's something that they yell at games. And I want to say that Jacksonville Jaguars don't technically play in the city of Jacksonville. They play in Duval County.
Oh.
And it's a big thing that they do. And they've gotten letters at the Good Place about that. Like, if Jason was really a Jacksonville fan,
right,
he would know this. So they made sure they put it in there. So thank you to all the Jacksonville Jaguar fans that sent mail.
Just remarkable.
And now you know that people really do listen to you when you write a letter.
It's true.
Sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, the writing of The Good Place is crowdsourced. Who knew? I also love in this episode that Michael's knowledge of Eleanor comes into play, because he sort of finds her alone and works his way into her heart through shrampies, which he knows she'll accept. Yeah. She's talked about shrimp for
them shrimps.
I don't know how many hundreds of years, potentially. Who even knows?
Didn't she get a shrimp dispenser at
she
some
did.
Point?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. She had a like a vending, like a pop machine that watch out for the secret flavor white chocolate,
yes.
I think.
Yeah.
So gross.
So gross.
But he has a moment with her and you know, is able to connect with her. Things aren't going well. And Michael and Janet, Michael initially proposes to fix the problem with arson. Was that a practical torch that he
yes,
had in his hand? Is that a real, real torch with
yes,
fire
it was.
In it?
Yes. We let Ted Danson have a real torch in his hand. That's how much we trust him.
Oh, my goodness.
He's America's sweetheart, isn't he?
Is he not? Oh, my goodness. He is. I like that dude. But he devises a plan where he is going to have Janet hold open the door to the afterlife while he goes, breaks his way into the judge's chambers and resets the Earth timeline. Does he know if he can do it? No. It's a desperate attempt. All that matters to him now are Chidi and Eleanor and Tahani and Jason. That's his crew. Those are his people. That's all that matters. And he's going to do this desperate thing. We don't know if it's going to work or they're going to get caught. They do get caught, not by the judge, but by the four humans.
Mm-hmm.
What happens now?
You'll have to tune in and find out.
Are you suggesting people should tune in next Thursday and every Thursday, 8:30, 7:30 Central on NBC?
I think that's correct.
I guess at this point, all that's left to say is ventromedial prefrontal cortex. Ian Phillips, what's good?
Family is good.
I like it.
Having that group, just like we see in the show, whether your family is friends or blood, that's what's good.
Finding your people. I like it.
That's right.
Beth McCarthy Miller.
You didn't say coworkers. Thanks a lot, Ian.
Well, I mean, you've been telling
me. No, no, you can't do it now. Can't do it now.
She said that she was going to punch me the whole entire time, and I've been waiting.
Can't do it now.
That's true. You've not poked him once.
Nope.
I know. All right. We'll find coworkers too.
Forget it.
I mean, at least.
Forget it.
It's got to be.
Nope.
We haven't worked together in.
Nope.
It's got to be at least 10 years. And it's only been like 7 for us, so.
It's true.
Beth McCarthy Miller, what's good?
Bill Cosby going to jail.
This has been The Good Place, the podcast. I'm Mark Evan Jackson. Thank you for listening. Now go do something good.
Janet, what have we learned today?
A good place was the place inside of us all along that was good.
Oh, Janet, have you been sneaking magnets again?
You've been sneaking magnets.
Oh, this podcast is available on Apple Podcasts and all major podcasting platforms, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hosted by Mark Evan Jackson.
Produced by Grant Rutter.
Written by Lizzie Pace.
That was Lizzie Pace.
Mm.
Music composed by David Schwartz.
Edited by Trey Booty. Booty?
Booty.
Oh, Janet.